second group in San Francisco in 1988, and the movement has grown to 1,000 different chapters around the world.
Characters
troupe that most of us are familiar with. They were doing a play in Golden Gate?
No, outside of the courthouse
outside
in San Francisco.
Outside of the courthouse on Keith McHenry's character of getting jailed. On the other side of the play, Keith was giving out free food and getting arrested by the royal police. It was written up in their book. That was a long time ago. And he's featured in PBS documentaries. Some of his accomplishments include pioneering the low-powered FM radio movement, co-founded San Francisco Liberation Radio, co-founded October 22nd No Police Brutality Day protests. He helped start Food Not Bombs movement. Helped start the Homes Not Jails movement, housing homeless in abandoned buildings in the U.S., co-founded Indie Media, set up kitchens at Camp Casey outside Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, coordinated the food relief effort for survivors of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, helped set up kitchens during Occupy, the Freedom Plaza in East Washington, D.C., and he helped organize recently the kitchen, the vegan kitchen over at Standing Rock last Thanksgiving. His Food Not Bombs has inspired movements such as Food Not Bombs, Bikes Not Bombs, and Really, Really Free Markets, Freeganism, Books Not Bombs. And he's received awards, including the Clio Award in Print Advertising in 1985, Resister of the Year in 1985 was the advertising. The 1999 Local Hero Award by the San Francisco Bay Guardian. The Advocate of the Year Award by the Arizona Coalition to End Homelessness in 2006. And the 2000 Noam Chomsky Award by the Justice Studies Association in 2012. And most recently, last month, or 2 months ago in January, the Hammer of Justice Award by the Santa Cruz chapter of the ACLU. And he's been interviewed by many, many places, New York Times, Tom Harpin, Learning, goes on and on.
Robert Norris. He interviewed me.
He's been on the front lines serving food to FEMA, National Guard, police, and survivors at Loma Prieta earthquake in San Francisco, 9/11, 2001, and the Christmas tsunami in Indonesia, although you weren't there at that one. Hurricane Katrina, 2005, Hurricane Sandy, 2012, and the cyclone in the Philippines. Those were other chapters of Food Not Bombs helping out. He's traveled all over the world, speaking at colleges at Harvard, Wesleyan, Vassar, in Nigeria, in Mexico, Vanderbilt, Brandeis, Oberlin, and more. Next week, he's going to be at Eugene. Keith has presented widely, including the Parliament of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, 2007, the Ross Spirit Festival, Farm Sanctuary, Vegan Thanksgiving, the National Animal Rights Conference, and many of those, Open Cages, and Ethiopian Vegan Association conferences, and on and on and on, Local to Global, Southern Cal Veg Fest. I'm almost finished. His personal archives are housed at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, Canada, and he also has a farm, a preschool in Taos, New Mexico.
I'm tired. Anyway, we're going to eat. No. Wow, I should retire. No. Anyway, some people here might not have heard of the founding story, which I think some people will find inspiring. And the purpose of tonight and how this evening came about is that with Trump coming to power and what's obvious, the liberal Democrats in Santa Cruz taking advantage of the chaos and sleight of hand to do things like put a fence around the downtown post office, for example, they have a permanent chain link fence now around the post office to keep the homeless away, or the efforts by far right wing groups and such in Santa Cruz try to stop food, not bombs. And you may have seen the petition going out. But the other thing that's happening is that there's a huge need to feed people. And we started counting the number of people, like trying to do this every single meal. We share every Saturday and Sunday at 4 at the downtown post office. We cook every Saturday and Sunday at Indian Joe's at noon, with the exception of the second Sunday, which is at 1:30, unless you want the free brunch, you can come at noon. And then we also provide meals at the Freedom Sleepers and arrive around 3 o'clock outside of City Hall every Tuesday night. And some of us sleep out all night long, and then we do a breakfast in the morning to protest the sleeping ban, because it's illegal in Santa Cruz to sleep outside between the hours of 11 and 8:30 in the morning. And this has resulted in a lot of suffering, including most recently the death of a friend of ours, Michael Mars, who died on the 17th of hypothermia on Potrero near River. And so there will be a memorial one of these Tuesdays for Michael and to remember him. And we had another memorial in the past for Chris when Chris died. And we have friends that are dying on the streets. And so all this anti-homeless organizing that's happening by our city government and is happening nationwide is something that we can see both a lot more of that with the Trump administration being in power, and we'll start to see even more people needing the food. So on March 5th, we counted 108 people eating, and we used to never get even like around 75 at the beginning of the month, because people still had checks and some food stamps left. So the end of last month, in February, I counted 121 people, but I was distracted, so I know I missed a bunch of people, and was probably more in the area of 150 people coming to eat. So we need people to help us cook, and we have sign-up sheets and everything. And so at the end of this, if you're inspired, we hope you become a dedicated, regular Food Not Bombs volunteer. So when I was 22, I was studying painting, as Abby had said, at Boston University. And one of my professors was Howard Zinn. He taught American History 101. And so I would go to those classes, and I was friends with a lot of the radicals at Boston University already. And, of course, Zinn was part of our little community. And he talked about how he was going up to Seabrook, a nuclear power station in New Hampshire, to try to stop the nuclear power station from going online, and he got arrested. And so I started working with Clamshell Alliance and the Coalition for Direct Action at Seabrook and going up to these protests. And so on May 24th, 1980, a friend of mine, Brian Fiegenbaum, a law student at Boston University, was arrested for assaulting a police officer. And essentially what happened was that a gaff hook that was to pull down the fence around the construction site broke from a rope and hit an officer. But Brian was on TV being interviewed, so they could identify him, and he was chosen as the criminal. And so the eight of us, including Brian, became a defense committee, and we started doing bake sales to raise money outside the student union or at the in Harvard Square or at Park Street Station in Boston. And we would usually typically make about $4 or $5, and it was very discouraging. And we're like, well, never going to have a defense fund out of this. And I had an old van, and I had a moving company called Smooth Move, and I was moving this family, and they were throwing out a poster that said, wouldn't it be a beautiful day if the schools had all the money they needed and the Air Force had to hold a bake sale to buy a bomber. And in other countries, I have to explain that, but in the United States, we all know that parent-teacher associations hold bake sales to buy school equipment, and yet 50 cents of every federal tax dollar that we pay in income tax goes to the fund the military. And so that gave us the idea to buy some military uniforms at the Army Navy surplus store and go out with our baked goods with the sign and tell people that we were going to buy a bomber. And if you remember, Ronald Reagan had just been elected, and that was the Trump event for those of us that are now in our 70s, etc. Right? So we, as young radicals, were like, oh my God, he's going to blow us up. There's going to be like a intercontinental nuclear missile going towards the Soviet Union. There used to be a country called the Soviet Union. And that we're all going to perish. So this was kind of the background. Very similar to, in some sense, what's going on now, although actually that seemed tame by comparison to now. And so so we were found that while we didn't make more money, a lot of people really liked what we were doing and would joke with us and talk to us, and the food slowed people down to read our flyers and so on. And we acquired a bunch of flyers by a move of the New England Free Press, including one of our local activists here, Phyllis Greenleaf's famous booklet on our changing sex roles and a feminist document that she published back in the late 70s. And then at the same time, as an art student, I realized it was wise to be a produce worker because you had to set out all the produce before school, because when the store opened, all the shelves had to look great with all the fresh lettuce and tomatoes and everything. And so being that I was helping do produce at one of the first organic natural food stores, a lot of people didn't know what the food was, and they would just leave it on the shelves, and it would start to wilt. And so I had boxes of old food that I couldn't sell that I started taking to the housing projects a few blocks away from this store called Bread and Circus, which is now Whole Foods in Central Square, Cambridge. And so I am delivering this food after work before I go to class and talking to the people there, and there's a new building being built across the street from them, essentially as close as the Paradox is to this room here. And they're saying, yeah, that's where they're designing nuclear weapons. And so I looked into it, and it was Draper Lab, and they were designing the guidance system for intercontinental nuclear missiles. And that gave me the idea that the term food, not bombs. It's outrageous that they're making bombs over there, and these people are desperate for food over here. At the same time, we realized that the people funding the Bank of Boston, the nuclear power station, Seabrook Nuclear Power Station, were actually the board members of the Bank of Boston, the board members of Raytheon Nuclear Missile Company. They were on Lockheed Martin, and they were also on the board of the company buying the nuclear power station, so that it was sort of similar to the economic arrangements that in the Roaring Twenties that led to the Great Depression. And our idea was that we would dress up as hobos, and we'd take some of this food that we're collecting, and we would make vegan meals out of it, and we'd take a big pot of vegan soup down to the stockholders meeting on March 26, 1981, at the Federal Reserve Bank at South Station, and we'd have like this literature saying, look at the policies of the Bank of Boston could lead to an economic crisis where Americans might have to stand in line to eat at a soup kitchen. And in 1981, Reagan had only been in power a short time, so the economy hadn't collapsed yet. There weren't lots of homeless people on the streets yet, so this was a street theater that we were going to be doing. And so we had this huge pot of vegan soup, and we had the eight of us, and we're like, that's not going to look like a soup line. We need to figure out some kind of strategy. We don't want to waste all this great organic food, so maybe we can find somebody that wants to eat it. And we heard of this place called the Pine Street Inn in South End. So we went down there and knocked on the door, and the people running the shelter said, oh, you can... we said, we want to tell everyone here that we're going to have a big meal and a protest tomorrow at South Station. And they let us in, and I gave a little talk to all these guys at midnight. And they're like, oh, this is great, a protest like the 60s, that's so cool. And I guess a lot of people don't go to shelters and give speeches in the middle of the night, but they were psyched. And so the next day, these people showed up. And so we had actually a line of people that came to eat. And the business people going by, stockholders, were like really shocked and go, wow, we've seen this in the movies, we've seen read about this and Grapes of Wrath and things like that. But we didn't know that this was happening now in America. And so as the day was winding down, guys that came to eat said, you know, you should do this every day. There's no food for homeless people in Boston. This would be fantastic if you did this every day. So that night we were washing all our pots and pans and everything. We go, yeah, let's just quit our jobs and do nothing but collect food and feed people and go around doing these kinds of, you know, street theater and taking food to housing projects. So that's what we did. And my boss at Bread Circus said, okay, you know, I gave 2 weeks notice, but I said, I'd like to keep collecting the food. And he said, that's cool. We could, you could do that. And so we ended up cooking up with White Wave tofu. Would bring in their little chunks of tofu and wipe in these 5 gallon buckets to the back of Bread Circus, and we collect that, the produce, and we got bread from bakeries, and we had a little route in the morning where we delivered it to housing projects, and people would know that we're going to come to their project on Thursday, their next project on Friday, whatever. We went to Rosie's place, the Battered Women's Shelter, with food and so on. And then there would be other people back at our place preparing a vegan meal to share on the streets. And part of our idea was that if we gave away vegan food, not only would we be feeding people directly and slowing people down to talk to us, but we would be able to get across the message that we could really end hunger if we went toward a more plant-based diet. And all the original 8 of us were all vegans, and so we obviously weren't going to be making meat dishes or egg dishes and stuff, so it was natural for us, and this is a way we can introduce people to the idea of ending world hunger by focusing on plant-based agriculture. And so we did just one brief story that was particularly funny at that time was there was a group called, there was a Pepsi, it was a company, and they had this thing called the Pepsi Challenge, and they set up right next to us. And what they did was they hired college students to open bottles of Coke and let them go flat. And then you would just see in the TV, or apparently, which we didn't see, but we heard about the TV, and the newspapers and radio and stuff, that you could stand in line and get blindfolded and see which is Pepsi and which is Coke. Well, the line just went right past our table, like dozens and dozens of people. And at that same time, a retired dentist gave us the same little cups that the Pepsi Challenge was using, because they were like the cups for rinsing out your mouth at the dentist. And we were getting all this tofu, and so we decided we would do the tofu smoothie challenge. And so we also, fortunately, because of moving the New England Free Press, had all these brochures about how Coke was hiring death squads to kill labor organizers in the sugarcane fields of Guatemala. So we had a big stack of those, and the people would want to go by our table, and we'd say, hey, take the tofu smoothie challenge. There's more nutrition in this one cup of tofu smoothie than in all the Pepsi products on Earth, and here's a flyer about how Coke is killing labor organizers in Guatemala. And the people were like, wow, that's like not what we expected when we saw the ads for the Pepsi challenge. And eventually they called the police on us, and the police came and said, look, these guys are friends with the city council. Funa Pons has been here for a long time. If you don't like what they're doing, then move to another corner. And sadly, they did, because we had to then come up with another kind of street performance after that, which we did, and this went on for years and years. And then eventually I moved to San Francisco, as Abby said, and I started a second group. And on August 15th, 1988, 45 riot police came out of Golden Gate Park and arrested 9 of us for sharing free vegan meals at the entrance at Hayden Stanyan. And the police made the mistake of some either calling or the police citizen band radio, whatever, alerted the San Francisco Chronicle to this fact, and they came and took photos. And then on the Tuesday morning, there was a very large photo of riot police guarding the food from the hungry, and people started to contact us very upset that people were being arrested for feeding people. So we had a meeting, and we decided we'd march down Hay Street. People brought pots and spoons as instruments. We brought the food to the inn. Some of you might have been at that action. And then we hand out the food, and this time they arrested like 24 people, and a new TV company had come named Cable Network News. And they had broadcast this worldwide, and people started to write letters and call us, seeing how they could get arrested for feeding the hungry in their communities. And I had been taking notes on how we started the second group, thinking, well, maybe some. Boston, there'll be three groups, one in Boston, one in Long Beach, and one in San Francisco. They really, we thought we'd be sued if we used their name. They said, no, no, just take the name, take the logo, just keep going. And so I made this flyer, and it became Seven Steps to Starting a Food Not Bombs, which I don't think I have on here. Usually I do. And then so I would mail that to you, and there used to be, like, you mailed things, and there was no internet, stuff like that. But anyway, so that all happened, and all these groups started happening. And eventually, over the course of, by 1995, there was roughly 1,000 arrests in San Francisco. Some of you were jailed during those arrests, and even got convicted and did time. And I ended up with 47 felony conspiracy to serve food in violation of the court order charges. We had lawsuits against the city, and it just, like, inspired groups to first start in a number of places in the United States and Canada. Eventually, there was a Melbourne, Australia Food Not Bombs, and a Prague, Czech Republic, food, or Czechoslovakia at the time, Food Not Bombs, groups in London, and so on. And it started to just take off. And there would then end up being, other arrests in other cities, including there was arrest down here in Santa Cruz during that time with soup without a permit and other such things. So this city was already, in fact, probably had for a while, been dedicated to trying to drive poverty and homeless out of sight rather than to actually solve the problems that were facing the people of Santa Cruz. And so then we ended up having two world gatherings in San Francisco, the first in 95, or 92, when there was San Francisco was designated the official city to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the invasion of North America by Europeans, and or Columbus Day. We met for 2 days before we fed that protest, and in those 2 days, we people from mostly Canada, or mostly United States, but a couple of people from Canada, decided that there would be three principles for Food Not Bombs, that the food would always be vegan or vegetarian in the case of the bread. Tonight, we have that issue of croissants that are probably not vegan, but everything we make is vegan, and it's free to everyone without restriction, rich or poor, drunk or sober. That's really key in a struggle like what we're having here in Santa Cruz today, because people do get 86 from food programs because they are drunk or, just not appropriate. And we don't have that. We allow people to eat no matter what at Food Not Bombs. The second one is we don't have any leaders or presidents or directors or a headquarters. I would be called a co-founder, as the other seven would be, but I don't have any more power other than that I talk a lot, and I'm unemployable, and I drive the van with other people, stuff like that. But otherwise, I have no official authority. In fact, in places like San Francisco, my opinion counts less than anybody else's because I'm old. And that can be the problem in some situations, but which is a good problem, actually. And it's one I commend. Support. The third final one, which is super important to the struggle here in Santa Cruz, is that we came to agreement, consensus, that also that we were trying to make decisions but using the consensus process, something that not always the best at, but it's definitely a principle, the second principle, no hierarchy. And that the third thing is that we're not a charity, but that we're dedicated to taking nonviolent direct actions to change society so no one has to eat at a soup kitchen and no one has to live on the streets. And that's where the issue here in Santa Cruz, and an issue I think is going to be getting more hotly debated over time, particularly as the Trump administration starts to get rid of things like health care, the Affordable Care Act, and all the other things, the tax on people that are, people trying to live, farm workers being deported, all the different chaos that is potentially potentially likely to happen, we will see increasingly larger numbers of people wanting to needing the food at Food en Avance, and we'll potentially find more and more both local and state and national pressure to get rid of groups like Food en Avance so that there isn't any political pressure to actually deal with the fact that so many people are struggling to live and in what should be this beautiful utopian Trump community. And so that is why we called people together tonight, is one, as the title of the talk says, don't mourn, organize, an old Joe Hill maybe statement or some at least IWW songbook type statement from before World War I, is that one of the ways that we can have hope and organize that I'm proposing and might be a good idea is that we get into groups like Food Not Bombs as affinity groups, and we do a combination of both practical things like feed people and also work together to resist what is going on. And so an affinity group is something you might not have heard of, but I was introduced to it as an activist in the 70s organizing against nuclear power and nuclear arms race. And it was also something that many people did in the Vietnam War period, organized against the Vietnam War. And there's been different versions of it, including during the Spanish Civil War and against fascism at that time. And so there's a kind of a history of this, and it changes as time changes, you know, as the conditions change. And the idea behind from this would be that you would get into groups of, like Food en Avance would be considered potentially an affinity group. And you would come and help cook and serve, and you'd go out on the streets and share food. And when there was like a we've already been in contact with people that want us to bring meals, breakfast, if there's a INS raid somewhere and they want the people blocking the INS to be fed, you know, that kind of thing. We've fed strikes, like the newspaper strike in San Francisco. We have a long history of providing bulk food to striking families so they can stay out longer, and providing meals on picket lines. And we've done that for a long time, so there's likely to be a lot more of that now. And so affinity group could be like in the Clamshell Alliance and in the Anti-Abalone Alliance out here, or Livermore Action, and these groups was groups of like, you know, 6, 10, maybe 15, 20 people who all knew each other and worked together on an ongoing basis, like we already are doing here in Santa Cruz Food Not Bombs, and building trust. And then part of what could happen, more ongoing than in the actions of against nuclear power and nuclear weapons, is that you'd have some of us would be willing to risk arrest if the situation was, you might end up potentially facing arrest. Maybe you're intentionally going to do something where you could be arrested, like block our highway or something like that, or take down the fence around the post office, something like that. And then others of you would know that you were not going to be getting arrested, and your role would be just as important as those who might be risking arrest. And that might be knowing that the birth dates of the people that are risking arrest, knowing if they have pets that need to be fed and watered, plants that need to be watered, being the legal support team on the outside. And that makes it much more comfortable for you, if you are willing to risk arrest, to know that you have backup, that your job is going to be called, that your roommates are going to know what's going on, that there's somebody that's going to talk to lawyers and get help raise bail and things, and it's already something in your community that you've talked about over and over again, and you know whose role it is. And to me, the fact that we did not do that before Occupy was one of the reasons Occupy is eventually became so easy to undermine. It's because we were on a big giant group of everybody. general assemblies and stuff. But in this case, we can have it so that groups are, you know, that you meet in a group, like all Fugamans would meet, and we would come to consensus about how we want to participate in whatever the action is or whatever. And then groups of groups would then send representatives to talk and so on. And so that there would be essentially a Santa Cruz cluster and maybe a, you know, a Monterey Bay or Northern Central Coast or maybe Northern California spokes meetings where all of us do stuff in harmony. And that's what we did in New England. We had a boss, we had an affinity group. I was in, at one point, Silverseed, and then there was an cluster meetings for all the groups in Boston, Cambridge, Somerville, and Medford, and so on. And then there was a Massachusetts spokes council meetings, and then there was one for all of New England. And then, but the decision of what to do in your actions was always came back to the local affinity group. So I'm proposing something like that. And the other aspect of that, you know, like when I was in Silverseed, we would meet at the food co-op, Boston Food Co-op, Monday through Friday at about 7 in the morning. And we would be in our jogging clothing, and we'd all run for about an hour, maybe 45 minutes through the neighborhood, because we were going to be physically fit for the next protest. And then we had, like, bake sales. And then we had, you know, we raised money to buy gas masks and all the stuff you need when you go to a protest, you know. And then we had, and camping equipment stuff, because we're going to climb over the fence at the construction site and live there all winter long. And then, you know, that kind of thing. And Stan, the other thing is we've got, you know, Reagan and Iran-Contra and the war in El Salvador and all these horrible things going on. And the little group of us could all, you know, study those issues, talk to one another. At least we had a family that we could depend on, that were radical and could share values and could support one another. And so I think both of those kind of ideas at this point in history might be really, really positive. So, you know, at some point we might want to organize, ultimately, like an affinity group formation meeting for Santa Cruz. And that might want to happen really fast as the developments are getting uglier and uglier really rapidly with our own liberal democratic institutions here in Santa Cruz. So that is one of the things. Now, in every, like affinity groups, food, for instance, is a really valuable task to be doing in the course. Not that Napoleon is somebody to be honored, but he did note that an army moves on its stomach. And so you can do a long action for months if everyone has access to regular food. So being in a Fugamans affinity group could be one of the most effective ways to help move forward any kind of resistance here against not only the local policies, which are so disruptive, but also the national policies, which are being expressed locally with things like INS raids and so on. So that would be kind of my suggestion as a way of organizing against fascism. And I have to say, I've been doing a lot of writing. You might have been reading way too many of the things I post on the blogs and stuff. But, you know, there's a lot of things going on. And in Santa Cruz, again, you know, we've been told there's an effort to try to stop us from feeding people. We have over 1,000 signatures on an online petition and hundreds of signatures from people living on the streets to protect the right to share food and literature and everything in that, the post office. The people trying to get rid of us have proposed that we could go indoors somewhere and feed people, which would, first of all, completely make it impossible to do outreach to the community about these important social issues. That's part of the reason we're so visible there with the Food on Bomb sign and everything, is we want people that, and we've run into this, I think any of our volunteers have run into this, people that had no idea that there were other people that didn't like what was going on and walked past discover, oh, well, I have kindred souls here at Food Up Bombs, and then they become active with us. That's, I think, is really, really important. Now, the other thing that the people trying to get rid of the homeless and Food Up Bombs have suggested is that the city look into hiring a person by the name of Robert Morbutt, who is an expert in ending homelessness. And he has come up with this theory that if you have what he calls street feedings, feed people outside, it keeps people homeless. They want to be, they won't go get services. Like if they ate indoors, they would get services. And he really strongly implies in his publications and so on, which he promotes to local city governments, that essentially people are homeless because they are personal failures, they are alcoholics and drug addicts, and it's quite clear in his literature that the economy plays no role in this, that essentially if you get clean and sober, you will rent an apartment. And the way you would get clean and sober is by eating indoors. And as we know, many of the people eating at Food Up Bombs eat at St. Francis, for example. Or they eat at the Little Red Church. Or they eat at other indoor food programs. And those same people are coming to Food Up Bombs on Saturdays and Sundays. Or eating with us at the Freedom Sleepers on Tuesdays. And if anybody's tried to get alcohol or drug services for somebody living on the streets here in Santa Cruz, that is essentially impossible. So I do not fault St. Francis for not having everyone that wants access to addiction services to be provided by St. Francis, because it's just not possible. And the homeless, as Robert likes to say, lack of services center, they don't seem to be diverting everybody into rehabilitation programs, as Robert Morbutt suggests. So that is, I think, this policy, this ideology. You may recall there was a thing called the Broken Windows Study. And then there became quality of life enforcement programs. And you have those kind of things here where you just can't sit on Pacific Avenue, for instance, or you have to only sit now in the little brass areas, and you can't sleep outside between 11 at night or in your car.